This is the Funny Girl Podcast, a podcast about musicals with stand-up comedians. Hello there, and welcome to the Funny Girl Podcast. This is the second one. The first one was with David Morgan. He was a very funny comedian. We did that in my Edinburgh flat. And this one was at my Edinburgh flat as well during the Fringe. We recorded them on the floor of my bedroom with gin and party rings. Because I know how to treat my guests. It's quite a very specific rider. But we had a real, real giggle. It was with Vicky Stone, who's a musical comedian. And she was wonderful. She was fascinating to talk to. Not only because she's a friend of mine and I learned so many things about her, but also because she is trained in musical theatre. She's been a jobbing musical theatre actress, been in that industry since she was a child. So it was really insightful to hear about the parallels between doing stand-up comedy and musical theatre. That is a train, because I am now at home in Manchester, so I will be heckled by public transport and my cat and a variety of things, because this is my incredibly glamorous day-to-day lifestyle. But I do have a desk now and a swivel chair, so let's do this. This is a professional outfit. Bit of admin before we start the podcast. There is an out of Twitter, hooray, for this podcast. It's at FunnyGirlPod. Please do not hesitate to tweet me. I would love to hear your thoughts and your feelings, fellow musical stand-up geeks. Maybe we could figure out some sort of, you know how it's like actor slash director, or, you know, like Brangelina or things like that. Maybe we could figure out some sort of stand-up musical mashup word, like stemusical. Something better. I'm not really thought it through. I have the swivel chair, but I've only just sat in it. So you let me know your thoughts. But yeah, Vicky Stone, this is going to be great. Please listen out for the mime welding story. That's a particular treat. But yeah, please do enjoy. Thank you very much, guys, for listening. So hello and welcome. It's my second podcast. My guest is currently in a party ring. It's absolutely fine. You fill your boots. I will introduce her while she's finishing the last morsels off. Because I know how to treat a lady. We have gin. Clink my glasses. There we go. Yep. Gin and Fox's party rings. I'm not sponsored or affiliated in any way, but they are smashing. So I'm going to introduce my second guest. I'm very, very excited to be introducing my second guest because it is comedian. In fact, I'm gonna do a new way how to introduce my guest. I'm gonna compare her to what I think she is as a musical theatre character. So I think if you took Molly from Annie, and then you took Velma from Chicago, and Rizzo from Greece, and put them all together, I think you would have the most wonderful Vicky Stone. Yay! Oh, thank you for coming and doing this, mate.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I think I bribed you with gin. This is the way forward.
Do you know what I mean? I'm easily bribed.
What's your favourite biscuit if it wasn't party rings?
Well, it depends. I mean, I like a biscuit that has something going on. So I like a bit of jam.
Layers.
In the
mid-
do you know what I mean? It's got to have jam in the middle. Or, you know, those weird kind of hobnobs that come with caramel.
Oh,
or like a
fig
roll. Is it a biscuit?
In fact, we got tweeted. I asked people if they wanted to ask you any questions. And the only person that tweeted was somebody who went, "What are your thoughts on hobnobs and Nutella?"
Yeah, it's because I tweeted about it earlier.
Oh, really? I see. I thought he would, yeah. I thought it's not really in the context of musical theatre. But...
I don't, to be fair, I don't think my followers understood the question.
Oh, okay. That's fair enough. The more biscuit-based lot, that's fine.
They are.
Because we're at the Edinburgh Fringe, how is your Fringe going anyway?
It's going really well. It's,
you're doing about
good.
Three shows? Are you just doing two? You're doing a play?
I'm doing a play and I'm doing my show, and then I'm doing other stuff every day, like kind of compilation shows. And,
thank you very much for squeezing
My pleasure. Always got room for you.
Bloody hell. I'm excited to interview you because you, every time we gig together, you're amazing because you tell me like proper old, it's like you're an old pro theatre person, like you're some sort of like Norma Desmond. You'll be like, when I was in the ABBA troupe, Kate, what? Sorry, Vic. When I was in Panto, excuse me? It's like you've been doing this forever.
Well, my first Edinburgh Fringe was when I was 12.
What?
I was at the George Square Theatre.
And you're Sarah Jessica Parker. Have you actually been doing this since?
I hate to use this word, but I was basically a kind of a classical musician from a very young age. I suppose a bit of a child prodigy. So I got my grade 8 flute when I was 10. And I toured with the National Children's Orchestra. So I was playing like big concert halls from when I was 10, 11 years old. So I don't know. I don't literally don't know anything else.
I was a spirograph prodigy. I was really good at spirograph. That's about it. That's incredible.
But yeah, I was in the National Youth Music Theatre when I was 12. And I played in a show called The Ragged Child at the George Square Theatre.
So you've been coming to Edinburgh for, like, if you think about all the stuff you did as a child, how many Edinburghs is this? Do you know?
I don't know. I mean, there was a big gap. So I did 3 years of National Youth Music Theatre. Jamie Bell, who became Billy Elliot, was in Ragged Child with me.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know what? I had, like, a massive crush on him when he was Billy Elliot. Mm. I was only, like, a year older than him, but I thought he was quite a cute little biscuit.
Yeah. So yeah, so National, this is a podcast about musicals. So yeah, I was in the National Youth Music Theatre for about four productions, and we did two shows of a show called Creation, which was at Edinburgh Cathedral.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so Ragged Child was the other one at George Square, which is now a kind of comedy venue, but at the time it was kind of a musical venue, and it wasn't attached to Assembly Rooms. It was just called the George Square Theatre. I did 5 years of Edinburgh's doing plays and musicals from about 12. Until I was maybe 16,
because I want to ask people that, because when I was chatting to David, he was in lots of Amdram stuff.
Yeah.
But has it always been professional stuff?
I did Amdram to the point where I did like summer musicals, but that was probably when I was about 8. So yeah. I was doing professional.
Straight away.
I was doing, we did at National Youth Music Theatre. We ended up in the West End. I was in Oklahoma in the West End.
What were you? Just like.
I was Gertie Cummins. So she's the one that.
That's amazing.
She's the one that's the one with the stupid laugh.
Yeah.
But I also understudied Ado Annie. So I played the one that does the I'm just a girl who can't say
yeah.
no.
Yeah, she's one of my favourites actually. I think if I could play anybody in musical theatre, I would. Yeah, she's one of the.
Yeah, ones. So I got to. I mean, luckily for me, the girl that played Ado Annie in the West End when I did it, she got. I can't remember what she got. I think she got laryngitis. Luckily, so I went on. So I got about 7 shows. So.
This just sounds like
this is now
this.
Showgirls.
This
I'm
is,
like
yeah, I was
pushing
say.
Someone down the stairs to get on.
Because you can't see on a podcast, but there was a little bit of glee in Vicky Stone's face.
Of course. It's like, she's got laryngitis.
Sheldon Freuder. Mm,
ching, ching. I'm on. Yeah.
So what theatre was that?
It was at the Peacock Theatre. So that's part of Sadler's Wells now, but the Peacock Theatre is off Kingsway.
Oh my god, so like this is amazing. I'm actually talking to someone who's been properly been in musicals for the proper theatre.
Yeah.
Do you like watching them though? Do you like also watching them as well as, or do you get that thing of, oh, I want to be doing it, or I could do that better? Or
well, it's kind of half and half. So I ended up, so I did all the National Youth Music Theatre stuff, and then I went to drama school.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the Royal Academy of Music.
And now you got into comedy. It's a fascinating story because I want to hear how this all happened. Were you intending to always go into musical theatre?
I was always intending to go into musical theatre. So I did, it's a postgraduate musical theatre course, that's what I did. And I did that. And I always intended to go into musical theatre pretty much straight out of when I graduated. I ended up working for a company called The Watermill, who do musicals up in Newbury, but they do something called actor musician shows where they do musicals, but the actors also play all the instruments as well. So I play the flute, play the piano, all that kind of stuff. It makes things cheaper.
Yeah.
So they basically don't have to pay a band. So it's
it's a clever way.
It is a clever way of doing it. And also, there's people out there that do it. And so I ended up doing a show called The Firebird at the Watermill in Newbury, and then I did a show called Time's Up at the Shaftesbury Theatre. Which is
oh, you didn't see the hand choreography that went with that one. Do it again.
Time's up. it's a sort of jazz hand, but with no spirit fingers. Just to sort of explain the move there.
Yeah.
But it was a musical, dreadful musical, absolutely horrendous. It was written by a guy called Ray Cooney, who writes a lot of fast plays, and it was the music was written by a guy called Keith Strachan, who is most famous for writing the theme tune for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Mistletoe and Wine.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, the guy is a millionaire.
Just from those two things.
But that's basically all he's written. And so I don't know what part of him thought, I can write a musical.
But what a bizarre life to have just written. I mean, the two of the things that are under public conscious so massively, but to have only written those two bits.
Yeah, to only
music.
Really, like, but how different, and Mistletoe it. And Wine, and that's the...
So was it, I mean, objectively, when you look back, was it not great?
It was an absolutely horrendous musical. It was, so, I mean, imagine, if you will, a musical about, the main protagonist was a guy who quit smoking. And goes to see a hypnotherapist to try and quit smoking, and he discovers he was a gangster in a previous life. So I played such roles as, so the hypnotherapist was Asian, and so he had a Bollywood number, except that they couldn't afford enough Asian girls to be in the Bollywood number, so I was in the Bollywood number.
Right. Is it a bit like a school? Is it sort of feel a bit like a school play?
Except it was in a West End theatre.
Right.
Except it's in the 1,500-seater Shaftesbury Theatre.
Oh God!
But at the time, that this was pre-Hairspray, where everything died in the Shaftesbury. So everything that went to the Shaftesbury until Hairspray.
From what point do you know? Just.
Oh God!
Since
for years,
time
and years,
has
years,
began.
Yeah, because it has no footfall. It has no passing trade, the Shaftesbury. So people don't see the outside. You know, you don't see the business. You know, you don't walk past and go, "Oh yeah, that's on."
Oh, I think I know which one it is. Is it it's in the middle of a load of shops, and so it's quite. I don't know.
It's on the corner of the end of Shaftesbury Avenue. So it's out by the end of Covent Garden, but like out like Bloomsbury end of things. And so Hairspray's there. Rock of Ages was there before it moved to the Garrick. But at the time. We were just after a show called Bat Boy, and before...
Is it what I think it is, Bat Boy? Batman, but like as a child?
No, it's about a boy that's in a community that he looks a bit like a bat.
I just thought there was like some awful...
And before that, it was Toya Wilcox in Calamity Jane. That didn't do very well either.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That surprised me, actually. I would have thought she'd be quite good at that.
I Dead with David...
Although, like, I was chatting to David about this last week about even though musicals are a guilty pleasure, but about ones that are your guilty pleasure, like you probably shouldn't like anymore. And Calamity Jane was one of mine because it's actually a bit wrong in some bits, like woman's work. Da, 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 da.
Yeah,
it's like the first sort of she's all that, isn't it?
It is, but the thing about Calamity Jane is the song Secret Love. It's
beautiful.
Most people kind of looked at that and gone, well, of course it's Calamity and Katie. It's about them being together.
Oh my gosh.
Essentially, it's a lesbian song.
I never knew that.
But that is what's kind of widely thought as being the once I had a secret love.
Well, I thought she was on about Owen Keel.
Yeah, but that's what you're meant to think. But you know, they set up home together. They're in the matching dresses. You know.
Okay, now that makes okay. I'm gonna watch it with that new hindsight. Uh-huh. Seven Brides for Seven Brothers is another one where I don't think I should like it anymore. I adored it as a child, but when you actually watch it as an adult, you realise they've just kidnapped and all those women and forced them to stay in a house for 6 months.
But, I mean, there's a lot of men that could jump in that
rooftop.
So.
Now, the dance routines are some of the most exceptional. I think, is it Michael Kidd who does the dance for that? All the axe jumping and all that. All that shit is incredible. So, after you did... Time's up. What catapulted you? What was the thing that made you go, I don't know whether I want to do musical theatre, I want to do comedy?
Well, it was kind of interesting because I was at the Royal Academy of Music and a lot of my peer group, my very best friends, one of them, a girl called Verity Quaid, went straight into Jerry Springer the Opera. So
she
went straight into Jerry and she understudied Alison Jair, the one that sang the song... I just want to fucking dance. That one with the pole dancer. She went straight into that. And my friend Helen, who is now in Call the Midwife, Helen George.
Oh, cool.
I mean, she was also in a musical called Gutted, which was written by
Danielle Ward.
She went straight into The Woman in White, the Andrew Lloyd Webber that was at the Palace. So a lot of my friends went straight into musicals, straight out of college into musicals, and people that I thought I was as good as. You know, that I couldn't really see there was any kind of difference. And I didn't have an agent. I left drama school without an agent. And mainly because our grad show was Sweeney Todd. And I was the second choice for Mrs. Lovett. And Verity, the one that went into Jerry Springer, was Mrs. Lovett. And so it was kind of between me and her.
It's difficult in those kind of things. My sister went to Arts Educational and she was very lucky in her final showcase. They did Madeline Mansion. She was Aldonza. So she got an agent and stuff out of it. But then she found it really, after about a year of trying to get acting roles, she just didn't want to be in that world anymore. She made her feel really bad about herself.
Well, it was tricky because, and so I went from potentially being Mrs. Lovett to being in the ensemble. So I you know, was just basically someone that was scratching in the back, giving it a bit of, God, that's good, that is the, how, you know, the,
Do you think it's a bit like being in Edinburgh, in that, like, the ones that are a bit more famous are doing the biggest things, they kind of get the most attention, and then you kind of feel like if you're in the back, you have to work harder, but you don't get seen as much, is it?
Yeah, although...
Because you spend all that money as well at drama school to be in the chorus.
But the problem is that at least with comedy, if you're good, you will progress.
Yeah.
And that is just a fact. Yeah. Whereas in musical theatre... Which is why
everybody's great.
Yeah, and why I went and why I ended up in comedy is that I had an agent and I ended up doing like several like good fringe stuff, and I did Time's Up and I did stuff at the Waterman. And I did stuff for a company called Theatre Clwyd in North Wales, which is a really great, really great kind of. They produce a lot of musicals and I worked for them. And so I was working. I ended up doing 5 or 6 pro musical jobs at coming out, but I wasn't getting seen for West End shows. I mean, I got through several rounds of Mamma Mia, got through several rounds of Les Mis, being seen for second cover Mrs. Lovett, and second cover and the two comedy best friends in Mamma Mia, but wasn't getting the jobs.
How is that? I mean, does it start to get exhausting after a while?
Oh, it's completely exhausting because you have to have jobs like, and everyone I knew at the time, we were all doing the same thing. We were all spraying perfume in Harrods.
You know? Really? Yeah, so you kind of would like kind of let on to each other, like, how did you get on that audition?
Exactly.
Like...
So everyone in this kind of musical theatre land basically works. Counters, makeup counters, employ actors, out of work actors, to blag working at the makeup counters when someone's sick. So you stick on a Clinique, coat, and absolutely blag your way through. Helping someone about Clinique products.
Is that a proper thing that all department stores do?
Basically, yeah. And so what you do is that you'd be booked into work, you get a call in the morning and you go, right, tomorrow you're in Selfridges, tomorrow you're in Harrods, tomorrow you're in House of Fraser. And so, and it was all, and you'd know other actors because everybody would be doing it. And so everyone was in Selfridges and whatever doing this job and then auditioning and
did you start to know other people as well? Is it a bit like the comedy circuit?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody's in the same boat. And the most interesting thing is that even when you've been in a West End show, let's say you go and get Les Mis, in a year's time, once your contract ends, you're back in Selfridges. Like there is no like it's.
Is it very rare for people to have a job before the last one finishes?
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty much unheard of. So you and as soon as you get in, it's not like comedy where let's say you've had a really good Edinburgh and things go well.
You're on the rise, then you're
headlining, then you're this. With musical theatre, you get a job that job goes. You're back at the bottom in the par with everybody else,
still fighting,
waiting for the next thing. And so I'm really proactive, and I'm someone that can't sit and do nothing.
Yeah.
And so I was doing these auditions, and I also started to play up in auditions as well. So
in what way? Like you just kind of like you do well, it in a subversive way or
yeah,
the way
or I'd also because I always wanted to be to do the funny parts, and by this point I hadn't thought about doing stand up. So for stuff like I went to audition for Footloose that was in the West End, and I took the song Flashdance, very standard choice. To audition for Footloose. I hadn't practiced it. I hadn't practiced the song. I got the sheet music. I hadn't looked at it. I thought, I know this. I'll do it in karaoke. I'll give it to the pianist. And I hadn't cut the fucking dance breaks. So someone on the piano is playing. I mean, you can imagine what that sounds like. And so I'm stood there going, oh my God, I'm just standing here. And there's a dance break going on. I thought, well, I'm not a good dancer, so I'm not gonna dance. And so I'm on the panel. There's a guy called, there's Jason, the producer, and there's Arlene Phillips at the time. Well, this is pre-Strictly, because she was still choreographing. So Arlene Phillips is on the panel, and this dance break is playing. And I don't know what in my brain made me do this, but I started to mime pulling down a mask. And then I went...
What?
And they looked at me, and I literally said the words, I'm welding... And then started to sing, what a feeling! And they and Arlene's hand went up and went, thank you very much, we've heard enough.
That is spectacular. You mimed welding
I mimed welding a genuine audition for a West End show. But there was something at the time in me that was like...
Do you think it was like self-sabotage? That you were like, yeah. Part of you was like, I just don't know why I'm doing this anymore.
And so I went to see her. My friend Pippa Duffy, who played one of the leads in Pete vs. Life, the sitcom that had Rafe Spall in it. And then she was Alan Partridge's assistant in the Mid-Morning Matters online.
Yeah.
She's trained with me as well. So she was at the Royal Academy as well. And I went to watch her in a play. And she was in this dreadful play. I hope she doesn't listen to this. She was in this awful play.
She was great, though. You were great. Yeah.
She was in this dreadful play at the German Street Theatre. And it was one of those plays that you're watching it and it's like, oh my God, this is crap. And then as soon as it started to get intense, they revealed that it was a play within a play. And then it was a play within a play. Within a play, within a play, within a play, within a play.
Like a Russian doll.
Oh, it was awful. And I just sat there pissing myself, and it wasn't meant to be funny. And there was a guy, so I was on my own watching this, and there was a guy that was also watching it with me, a guy called Bill Dare, who I didn't know. But he was also laughing. And his friend had written it. And we went to I was in the bar waiting afterwards for my friend. He was waiting for his own. We were both on our own. And we got chatting. And we were both like, well, that was not meant to be funny, was it? And we were like, no, it wasn't meant to be funny. And we just started talking. And I ended up talking to him. He's introduced himself and said that he was a comedy radio producer. And I sort of asked him, going, God, how do you get into comedy? I really would like to get into comedy. And he went, how do you get into sitcoms? You know, I can't seem to get castings for anything. He went, oh, nothing casts. Get into stand-up. And so
sort of drink in a pub. Someone just went, why don't you?
It wasn't even like, why don't you do it? He was like, well, that's how you get in, do stand up. And so I went, I found being an actor, I was a member of the Actors Centre in Covent Garden, and they did a course in stand up comedy. Right. And so I did, it was, you know, half a day a week for 4 weeks, and I did a course. And,
did you automatically put music into it, or did you do it you on the microphone stage?
Well, it was so interesting because the guy that taught the course, I would have thought would have been more intuitive. It was all actors, and virtually everyone in the room did a character because they were actors.
Yeah.
No one was actually brave enough to stand on stage and be themselves.
Tell jokes, yeah.
Now, Hattie Ashdown, do you know her? She's just written for Sky about it's a sitcom for Sky about promo girls. So that's being filmed at the moment.
That's based on when you guys all did Harrods and stuff like that.
It's just because we were actors and so everyone was a character doing stand up.
Yeah.
She was a beautician and my character, and I've never ever done this on stage since. My character. My first foray into stand-up is that I dressed in leather trousers and a leather top. I don't know where I got it from. And I had an accordion. And
okay.
Yeah. And my character was the owner of the Greenwich Pie and Mash shop and tried to...
Were you basically being Mrs. Lovett?
Yeah, but trying to lure cats to put in pies, and so there was a wooden spoon attached to the top of the accordion, and I would lure cats to me by playing the theme from Cats on the accordion.
Is it weird, Vicky, that I don't think this is like that far removed from like what I would expect you to do?
Yeah,
is that...
And so basically, I think I did 3 minutes of chat about catching cats. Then played Cats. Smack. And that was the act.
Did you ever do it in front of anybody?
We did a showcase at the end.
Right, yeah.
That was what I did.
How did it go down?
I have no idea.
I do not remember any of it.
No. I think it was fine. I don't remember dying. But after that, I was like, I can't do that again, and I was myself.
Right. So. But it didn't put you off doing like stand up for doing that. Like it didn't put you off. It just made you think. I don't think character.
Well, I don't know what it was. I can't really remember it that well. But after that, I did stand up with no music. So I started doing open mic spots, but doing 5 minutes of just stand up.
Right.
So no music, no singing, just chat. And then somebody else said to me, "If you've got other skills, use them."
Right.
And at that point, I hadn't even considered, singing or doing comedy songs. It hadn't occurred to me.
That's interesting. Yeah. It hadn't been like, oh well, this would be an obvious thing to do. So I mean, when you got behind a keyboard and started doing the comedy songs, did it feel more comfortable?
I didn't get behind a keyboard.
Did you not?
No. And so the strangest thing was, I'd done 10 gigs right up to at this point, and I had a backing track for a song that I'd written, and it was a song that was called She's Thin, and it was about. It was about my friend Helen, the one that's in Call the Midwife, right. I mentioned earlier. And we used to live together. And she's just really thin and doesn't have to work at it. And it really fucks me off. I wrote a song about, you know.
Your pain.
Yeah. So I wrote a song about that. And I made a backing track. And I spotted a advert in the Stage. Of course I would, because, you know, you were out of work acting, you scour the Stage for jobs.
I used to read the Stage when I was a kid, just because I found it fascinating. I used to read all like the what auditions pages.
And there was an ad in the Stage for a stand-up comedy show called, I can't remember what it was. Oh, damn it. It was an NBC show. It was an American show that Matt Kirshen.
Last Comic Standing?
Last Comic Standing.
Yeah.
And there was an advert for Last Comic Standing. And so I went and stood in the queue. I went and queued outside the Comedy Store because there was people that were invited by their agents.
Yeah,
it was also,
open
call. And I was so used to standing in a queue for open calls because I'd been to the Mamma Mia open auditions. And, you know, I've queued for 4 hours around the back of the Prince of Wales Theatre, standing in a queue for a Mamma Mia open audition. And so I got there really early because I was like, right, you know, it's an open audition. I'll get there. Yeah. So I bastard there for hours. So just me standing outside the Comedy Store.
Just on your own.
Yeah, because there was... Because comedians don't, there isn't the American.
No.
Yeah, because I guess they thought as well, the queue would be around the block. And so I stood there and I was in the front of the queue, and then about 7 other people joined me. But then I guess there were maybe about 50 by about the time it was about to start.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, if you for Mamma Mia, the queue would be 500 strong.
Yeah,
by
not
the
like
time
50.
At 9 a.m. when the auditions are meant to start. So you'd get there at 6 to make sure that you get seen.
Crazy.
Yeah, and so I didn't get there at 6, but I got there like an hour before it was meant to start, so that it was, anyway, I get there, I do this song with a backing track, I do the material about dieting, it was all, you know, just some stand-up about dieting. I'd done 10 gigs at this point, and I got through. So I got through to the what was essentially the British final at the Comedy Store on my 10th gig, and it was, I didn't know who any of these people were at this point. So I was on stage, I was sharing a bill with Glenn Wall, who else?
Was
Matt Kirshen.
Jeannie Yashir.
Jeannie Yashir, whatever her name is. Tiffany Stevenson, Tin and Dweeb. Like, it was Josh Howie. I knew nothing about the comedy scene. I didn't know who a single of these people were. I didn't know who they were. Absolutely no idea. I come from standing in the queue for Mamma Mia, like not
like
10 days
previously. Like musical theatre kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, like just like, hey,
I only just had a song about being thin. Someone that picked me off when I was thin. And I went on stage and it went really, really well. I didn't get through to the American rounds, but I did, you know, I didn't embarrass myself. And that was that. And I
that's amazing. Went,
and at the end of the gig, I got invited to a party back at Matt Kirshen's place, who he shared with Nick Dooley and Carey Marks. And that was that. I was in the middle of the comedy
born.
Scene. Yeah. But
that's a very, like, as origin stories goes, that's pretty awesome. That's like a Bruce Wayne-esque kind of origin story.
Throwing
like,
you in the deep end.
Straight
certainly.
From musical theatre.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, as you can hear, I loved doing this podcast. I found it genuinely so interesting. And this second bit is brilliant because Vicky talks a lot in depth about her influences, what musical theatre composers influence her writing when she writes her comedy songs, how she's thinking about writing her own musical in the future. Also, we discuss at quite great length about singing through your vagina. It's a bit of an education for some of you. And it goes a bit weird, the sound, about 40 minutes. I apologise. I think I'd had a few gins by this point, and I think I did something to the microphone. So I'm very sorry about that. But I hope you enjoy the second half.
But there is stuff to rehearse. There is, you know, technical elements of it that needs to be right before I can show it to an audience. And also the nature of songs, that you can't blag a song. You have to know a song before you can perform it. And so there's a lot of stuff that you can do not in front of an audience, whereas other comics can't really. You can do it in front of a mirror.
You have a lot of self-discipline for that, though, which most comedians don't really.
But I also think that that comes from the training, is that I have self-discipline.
Would you? That's it. It's part of me. I'm institutionalised.
Yeah.
Would you ever? I mean, if somebody did approach you and just said, you know, do you with a great part, like we're gonna come to the West End and do a musical theatre, would you not do stand up for a while to do that, or would you rather?
I've thought about this actually. It's because I was having a conversation with a comic who has just taken a role in a musical for a year.
Mm.
I probably can't say who. I'm not sure it's been announced yet.
But don't worry.
But it is a comedian that's just taken a role in a musical for a year. And I wouldn't take a year's contract right now.
Yeah.
Because I think that I feel as though I'm progressing and moving faster than I would if I stayed.
It's a big commitment as well, yeah.
Well, I just think that, first of all, when I get bored of what I do on stage, I have the power to change it.
Yeah.
You go in a show, I reckon 3 months in, be bored. Yeah. And you have no control over that.
Yeah.
You have to turn up and you have to do it. So I would love to. I'd love to get to the point where I can do musicals and I can dictate how long I do them for. So I would like to kind of build my profile to the point where someone goes, "Would you like to come and be in this?" And I go, "Yeah, I'll be in it for 4 months."
What would be the perfect one? Like if I had loads and loads of money and I would let you go for however long you wanted to go for, what would the role be that would tempt you?
A, because I got close to it, and B, because it is just magnificent, is Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd.
I've listened to the soundtrack of the newest one with Imelda Staunton and the marvellous Michael Ball.
He is not a baritone, the tenor.
Is he in the... Oh, right, so is that like... Is he in...
He's in the wrong place.
Oh,
he's
in the wrong place. Oh, right.
The best Sweeney is George Hearn.
Oh, okay.
And the ultimate recording is Patti LuPone and George Hearn.
I think that is on Spotify because I've listened to that. Yeah. I was put off Sweeney Todd massively by the Tim Burton film. I hated it. And I thought, right, I'll give it a go because it's been, everyone's raved about it. And when I listened to their version, I actually fell in love with it. But I just, the movie.
Well,
it
also missed a lot of stuff out, the Tim Burton film.
It just sang so fast and didn't really, like, Helena Bonham Carter, I couldn't hear anything she was saying. It was like she was rapping.
And the Angela Lansbury recording, Angela Lansbury and George Hearn is amazing. Angela Lansbury is fantastic at it. She's someone that's like Elaine Stritch in that doesn't have a great set of lungs on her. She hasn't got great chops.
A bit like Judi Dench in a way. Like
exactly.
She's just great
they've nailed that kind of speech quality of singing.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you get that kind of, "Wait, what did you rap? What did you, Harry? You gave me such a... Well, I thought it was a ghost," that kind of stuff.
Yes, yeah, so it is a little bit like sort of a rapping...
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah. And you've kind of got to have that with Sondheim. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, the Tim Burton film just missed too much stuff out and kind of homogenised it.
I think it looked beautiful.
Yeah.
But I don't think the singing was a priority, the music necessarily. It was more the visual. So Mrs. Lovett.
Mrs. Lovett.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did you get to see that, the newer version, in the West End?
I didn't. No, I didn't see it. I had friends in it as well, and I should have gone.
You see, you're a very busy lady, so I can imagine you don't actually get to the West End often.
There's pretty much always a friend of mine in the show, because I, you know, from the training in National Music Theatre and all that kind of stuff, you know, it is sort of, you sort of guiltily chalk it up.
Yeah.
We were talking
last week about, I think David mentioned Elaine Stritch. I hadn't heard of her. But we were talking about grand dame sort of musical, and we don't really have that many of them.
No, I mean, we don't have any true... I think Michael Ball and Ruthie Henshaw were the last musical theatre stars to come through musical theatre. Now, we put stars into musicals. We put Justin E. Collins
so
in
do
a musical.
Oh, so do you think that's why there isn't really anyone coming up?
Because they can't sell tickets. So you put stars into musicals, you don't make stars with musicals anymore.
So do you think it's different in America, and do you think it's different in Broadway?
Yes, absolutely, because Idina Menzel is a musical theatre star. Kristen Chenoweth is a musical theatre star. We can't do it. We can't do it. Even someone like Jodie Prenger has come from a reality TV show.
Yes.
We aren't the... You don't go to drama school and then get a part, and then get a bigger part, and then get a bigger part.
Do you think it's because we don't premiere musicals here? We haven't really written any big ones? I mean, what do you think? Why do you think it is? I don't know.
I mean, someone told me the statistic that more people watch football live on a Saturday than go to musicals in an entire year.
Do you think also, though, that's the theatres and Because I can't, like, I absolutely adore going to the bits, watch shows, but I can't afford it. Do you think?
I think it's a massive thing. But the profit in West End theatres are in the gods.
Yes.
So, you know, and I think in many ways it's the same in Edinburgh. It's the same, you know, you put on a show, and actually the chance of making money is often in the last 10 seats, and it's the same, you know, and it's the same. It's the same in a West End theatre. Is that your show costs so much money to put on?
Yeah.
That last tier of seats, if you don't sell them, your show doesn't make any money.
Yeah.
And so they have to price it at that level in order to justify them at all. And I think that it just makes it. I don't go as much as I should. I only go when I've got mates that can do me a deal.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I went to go and see a Chorus Line. I waited to see that and got it £20 on lastminute.com.
How was that, by the way?
I thought it was really rubbish.
Oh, no,
I
really?
Did. Yeah, because...
The songs are so good.
But what they've done, what Chorus Line did is that they didn't update it. They left it in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they used the same choreography, and it was just... It just felt like a dated piece. I think at the time, in the 70s, to have an introspective musical about musicals was amazing and groundbreaking.
I've seen a documentary on Netflix. It's really fascinating how they did it. A bit like the Vagina Monologues in a way. They just had it recorded.
But I think nowadays, it was just like, meh, we know the show, we've seen it. I think they should have updated it in terms of, like, you know, bringing it into the modern day or whatever.
With all the reality TV shows.
Yeah, exactly. And you could have made it work. No, it was just dated. And... Although Summer Stranahan was excellent, you know, it was a bit like, meh.
Right.
And it's 2 hours of that in interval. 2 hours
there's
of that,
no interval.
But if you're going to make someone sit for 2 hours, it has to be really engaging.
It has
engaging.
To be excellent,
it has
yeah.
to be top draw, and it wasn't.
So, are you more, I was going to talk about sort of, you know, singer-songwriters, and who are you most influenced by, do you think, when you are writing songs? And who are people that really inspire you, who you love?
I think, as I said, Jason Robert Brown, previous show, not necessarily this one. I do get influenced a lot by musical theatre because, you know, I there's a lot of underscore in my show.
Yeah.
I show a video and I underscore it live. So there's kind of like,
that's great.
Yeah. And so I use a lot of musical theatre elements like that. And also,
do you like motifs that run through it?
Yes. When you see it, there is like bits of a first song that then reprise later.
That's incredible.
And there's also stuff like I'll use moments of recitative, so it won't be a whole song. It could just be a little bit of. I'll just sing for a bit to move the story along, which is of course something that they use a lot in Les Mis. So you watch Les Mis, the songs start and finish, but the story is moved along by recitative. And so, you know, who else is using recitative?
Yeah, I'm going to be honest, I don't know how many people in the comedy section are using. I can't even say that. I've had, well, 1.5 gins now. Recitative. I'm learning a lot. This is smashing.
Yeah. And so, and the thing is, I just do that. It's not because I want to show off.
Yeah.
It's just that I know what it is and I know what it does. And so I can just use that to kind of...
Do you think you'll write one Fringe?
Oh, yeah. Not next one, but the one after. That's the plan.
Is that you're going to aim? Have you even got an idea or anything?
There's a couple of ideas that I've been playing around with in terms of thinking about it. But I mean, you sort of there's been a lot of musicals that started in Edinburgh. Jerry Springer, the Opera started in Edinburgh.
Did it?
Yeah.
I loved that.
Battersea Arts Centre, then there's an hour version at Edinburgh, and then it went to the National. And I think that you look at Jerry and you look at Book of Mormon, there is an Avenue Q. There's a real appetite for comedy musical, adult comedy musicals.
Yeah.
And so, I'm not saying I can do something of that standard, but fucking hell, I'm going to
try. You can have a go, man.
I'm going to have a go. And that is the, you know, that is not next one, but the one after. That's the plan.
That's one of the goals, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I think I'd be able to do, because this year I've done a play and my own show, and it's been hard work, but I can do it.
Yeah.
And so... I would like to be able to write a musical.
And
I think it's going to take 2 years, but I'm going to start writing it. Write the musical and then also do a comedy show at the same time.
I'm interested. Do you think it would be one that is just like a Les Mis sort of situation where it is just all singing? Or would it be a book as well and it would be songs but broken up?
Yeah. It definitely wouldn't be sung through. I think that Les Mis...
That'd be a lot of work as well.
Well, also, the thing about Les Mis, the stuff that is sung through, like Woman in White, they're basically completely sung through, is that it's almost opera, those shows. And you have to have a very attentive audience. They can't relax at any point because they've got to digest new music as well as text. And so you have to, they have their ears have to have a break.
I'm going to be very excited to see that.
Marvellous.
So I was going to also ask, so obviously Mrs. Lovett is the one, it would be the dream sort of role. But if you could choose to be anybody in any musical, I guess stick to David, indiscriminate of sort of age, gender, height, speed awareness, who are the three do you reckon you would choose?
Okay, so I've said Mrs. Lovett, but I'll exclude her from the three. If I was a bloke, I would like to play Sweeney Todd, because Epiphany is one of the best songs in musical theatre. The other one I'd like to play is one of the greatest songs in musical theatre is The Soliloquy from Carousel. It's like...
Is that My Boy Bill?
But it's like five songs in one.
Incredible,
It's an absolutely insane piece of writing. It's Billy that sings the song. And I think it's just extraordinary. And so I would love to be able to have the voice to sing that.
I have gained a new appreciation for Rodgers Hammerstein as an adult. When I was a child, I think I actually thought it was all a bit twee and a bit like, oh, la, 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 Oklahoma Carousel. There's very dark undertones to what they do. There's very... It's very adult in some ways.
I mean, so do you know the kind of history of Rodgers and Hammerstein and how musical theatre actually started?
No, not at all.
I think it's really interesting how cyclical musical theatre is that prior to Oklahoma, and Showboat sort of did this, is that prior to that, musicals had pop songs in them. And so I've Got Rhythm is in about three musicals.
Like the Tin Pan Alley sort of era.
Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, you look at Anything Goes. The songs don't move the story along. They don't, it's just...
It's like the spectacle of it.
And so I've Got Rhythm was essentially a pop song. It's like the ABBA musical. You're just putting pop songs into a story.
Well, that's fascinating, actually, that it's a comparison.
So that we're now back to that. That's the only way we can sell musicals is pop songs. There'll be a One Direction musical very, very soon because they can sell tickets and their drives. And that's how it started, is that it's pop songs at a show. And then Showboat, Rodgers and Hart, the songs started to be in character. So you take Old Man River out of context, can only really be sung by a certain type of character, type of person. And so Oklahoma was the first musical that properly had songs that move the story along. That you take the songs out of context, or you take the songs out of the musical, and then there are gaps in the story. Before that, there weren't gaps in the story. The song
it's
just
very,
happened.
Very, very interesting. So
Oklahoma, Rodgers and Hammerstein was the first musical that did that. And so you also had dark characters like Judd Fry, who's the guy that's, you know, probably got autism or something similar. And he's the one, you know, you get this kind of...
It's quite menacing, and it looks at, you know, there's those things that he's looking at the naked picture of the girls, and there's this sort of underlying threat to her safety.
And so that was the first musical that had that kind of drama and that moving the story along. Also, what Rodgers and Hammerstein started was this idea of a dream ballet.
Yes, which I, actually in Carousel, I think is... Really, I'm not so sure. I was in a college version of Oklahoma. I was only in the chorus. I didn't get through. I didn't even make the callbacks for anyone. I was devastated. I cried in my car. It was really upsetting. But I was like, I don't think I'd be a very good actress. Cause I just get very upset. At the time, I didn't. I was going through a Kelly Osbourne phase.
Oh right.
I had a red Mohican.
You've only got yourself to blame then.
Yeah. They probably wouldn't have cast me anyway. I thought it was all right, okay, we're doing this at college, whatever. There's not really much to it. There's not really a core to it. But there's so much going on. It's amazing.
Here's a bit of Oklahoma trivia. Hugh Jackman is the first person to have been the same actor to have done the Dream Ballet and played the character.
Really?
So what happens in productions of Oklahoma is
they swap. Yeah.
And so Hugh and Caroline, what's her name, that played Laurie?
She had black hair, and I've never seen her anything else. She was very good, though.
Oh, she's been in loads of stuff. She's quite a well-known musical theatre actress. I saw her in...
Will was in Broadchurch.
Yes.
That was amazing. Yes. I was like, is that
he
Will?
He also did the lasso workshop for our production of Oklahoma at the Peacock.
Really?
Yes. We also had the same musical director that directed at the National. Guy called
Trevor. Not Trevor.
Musical director.
Okay.
But so Hugh Jackman is the first person that did his own dream ballet. There we go.
He can do anything now, Hugh. I was listening to the Boy from Oz soundtrack before he got here. He's fabulous. I don't believe that he's gay. I believe that he loves his beautiful wife. I have to. Oh. All right, so we have Billy from Carousel.
Yeah.
Who is a super, like, for the time it was made, he's a pretty edgy character. The fact that he's quite out there, that he beats his missus up, that he's quite, he's not a very nice man. No. And when he dies, it's kind of in a way, you don't feel that sorry for him. Yeah. It's kind of when he's actually dead, you go, oh, okay, well, he's learnt something brilliant.
Yeah.
What's the other one?
I don't know, it's tricky because obviously something like Ado Annie, I'd love to have another crack at. Oh, I know what it is. It's Little Red. Little Red Riding Hood in Into the Woods.
Oh, Into the Woods, right.
And I'd quite like to be in the new film, if that's...
There's a new film? Oh, right,
they're making a film of it, and Meryl Streep is playing the witch.
I saw Into the Woods. I think they did a televised version when I was a kid, and I watched a little bit of it, and I loved it. Because I never really thought of myself as a Sondheim. Are you a big Sondheim fan? Because...
I am to the point where, like, there's a song in my show that I wrote it, and then I went, oh no, let's make it Max Sondheim, and so and no, nobody notices or cares, but I care, and so there's a kind of the backing to the song is like ba 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 ba. It's an irregular time signature. The piano has an irregular time signature, but the vocals have a standard time signature.
Is that
a Sondheim thing? What happens a lot at Sondheim is you get this kind of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, ba 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 ba, and what goes on top of it is da da di da 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 da.
Is that why people that haven't got great voices are still quite good at Sondheim? It's more sometimes about the acting than the...
Absolutely. So Elaine Stritch is someone that became very famous for being in Sondheim. Her most famous role is in Company, where she does the "Here's to the ladies who lunch aren't they a drag?" That one,
and it's very so. I suppose he's very. Is it a lot of social commentary as well with Sondheim?
Yes, I mean the thing that Sondheim does is that he writes in speech rhythms. So for instance, Lloyd Webber doesn't write the lyrics. He writes a tune and sends it off to Tim Rice, make that work. And so often, it doesn't work in sentences.
Yeah.
So you don't actually breathe as a singer where the sentence ends or where there's a comma.
Yeah.
So the phrase will go, the musical phrase will go over the vocal phrase. So it's really hard as an actor to make that work.
Yeah, I think you have to be opera singers. That, like, I mean, what?
No, not for that. It's just you have to breathe in somewhere it doesn't make sense. Because Andrew Webber's gone, ba 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 ba, and you send it off. And gone,
there you go, do something with that.
And gone, oh, do you know what? That didn't work in The Beautiful Game. Let's stick it in The Woman in White. You know that, don't you?
Yeah. It didn't work in The Beautiful Game, put it in The Woman in White. Definitely now put it in Love Never Dies.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, just let it go, pal.
It's not that great. But what Sondheim does is that he writes in speech rhythms, and he also writes magnificently for women. So a lot of male writers don't actually write, he writes in that way, in that way for women, where the thought process is really quick. You know, that kind of, like the, wait, what's your rush, what's your hurry, Worst Pies in London, is definitely got that manic, like, hang on, multi thing. Whereas, let's take someone like Stephen Schwartz, who's a fantastic writer, you know, it's real kind of like lyrical, and you kind of got defying gravity. It was all long phrases. And actually, a lot of the time, women are much more kind of scatty, and, you know, when you're at your most manic, you're very unlikely
to be like, la, 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 la,
you know. Yeah.
And you'd be a cracking Elphaba.
Yeah, I think that was going to be my next one. Mainly.
I really think you
mainly
would.
Mainly because I'm pretty certain I could belt top Fs in a harness. That's the hardest thing about defying gravity.
And that's, because they go, like, you have to train it, being able to train for it.
It's essentially, what you need to belt that top F, the, so if you can't find me, not to the west end, that one.
Yeah.
You've got to stand on the floor, you've got to brace yourself to belt it, but you're not on the floor. You're being lifted. And so you literally will have, you'd have to, I spoke to someone that done it, what's her name? I've forgotten her name. She went to the drum school with me. Anyway, got it. She says that it's about pushing your pelvis into the bottom of the harness to brace your... Because you need to... It's what's called anchoring. So when you belt, you need to anchor your body in order to take the pressure. If you belt and don't take the pressure off your kind of throat area, you damage your voice. So you need to be anchoring so that you're basically engaging larger muscles. And you normally do that by kind of anchoring into the floor, pulling down your back, and belt.
Yeah.
But whereas when you're in a harness and going up, you've got to basically push your weight down into this harness, like into your pelvis, into your groin.
all the power's coming from your groin.
Yeah, essentially, belting through your fanny. That's what's... That is what's happening when you're playing Elphaba.
So every time, guys, you are listening to Defying Gravity, just think Adina is singing through her vagina.
That's what's happening.
I don't think people even think about it, because I remember watching Wicked, and it's amazing, but you don't think, bloody hell, she's working hard there. She is. Yeah. I mean, that's not easy to do.
No.
You don't think that. You just go, oh, okay, well, you know.
But that's because Adina Menzel makes it look easy.
She really does, though. She's smashing. Yeah. She really is. Do you have any sort of performer that you look up to and think, like is Adina one that you just think, God, your voice is incredible, and you know, you're chosen the right roles and you know what you're...
Yeah, I don't know. I think in musical theatre, I've become a little bit apathetic towards musical theatre voices, because I've been around so many excellent singers, and I've worked with, and I've kind of...
You've got a lot of its luck, like anything. Sometimes it's a lot of it's just the right person at the right time.
I mean, there are... The girl I mentioned earlier, Verity Quaid, I mean, my God, she's got some of the most insane chops. I mean, she can properly, like, be belting kind of A's, B's, like, real kind of up the top there, and just has the most insane range. And, you know, she should be a lot more well-known than she actually is. She has the voice for it, but, you know, as with anything in show business, it's not necessarily about...
How great you are.
I mean, there are so many other factors to take into it. I mean, you know.
Yeah, either where you look or where you are at the time. Or
who you know, how well connected you are.
Do you think there'll be another circle? Do you think there'll be like a lot of like maybe new singer-songwriter, maybe new songwriters, maybe new musicals, and the shift will now, it will go, you know, we talked a lot last week about the jukebox musicals with David, and whether he thought it was a good thing or a bad thing. And he said, you thought anything that brings people to the West End was a good thing. I mean, what is your opinion?
Well, my thing is that obviously to put on a musical is a very expensive and high risk process.
Yeah.
And so what you've got to do is you've got to get people into theatre. But the theatre is too expensive, and I think we can take Book of Mormon as an example. Yeah. Is that Book of Mormon is making people who would spend, let's take £60, although it's often more, they would spend £40 to £60 on a ticket to see a band that they liked and think nothing of it.
Yeah.
So those people who are comedy fans, who are telly watchers, who will go to watch live stuff, but not that often, are putting their hand in their pockets to the tune of £40, £50, £60 and booking for Book of Mormon. And they're booking 6 months in advance. So those 30-somethings who have not been, you've not been able to get before, are booking to go to the theatre now.
Yeah.
But they're booking very specifically to see something. The rest is being populated by tourists and musical theatre fans. But Book of Mormon is the first show to get people who don't necessarily like musicals.
But it's because it's South Park connection. And
they also like the idea of watching a musical, in inverted commas, that is about something that's really funny.
Yeah.
And so, you know, from my own writing point of view, it's kind of taking a step back and looking at it and going, how do you get those people? How do you get those people to part with their money? And so I think that jukebox musicals also get people that wouldn't normally be going to the theatre to part with their money. But
in a different, very different way.
In a completely different way. So either are valid. Now, the problem is that in the middle of that, a new Les Mis wouldn't happen now, because you wouldn't be able to sell it without a star. And without, you know...
Unless maybe it started at the Fringe. Maybe, you know, and do you just genuinely think it just wouldn't happen?
I just don't think it would happen. I mean...
Which is a terrible shame.
The problem is that you look at Merrily We Roll Along, right? That's been in the West End. It couldn't have had more 5-star reviews, and that closed. Right. You know, the fact is that great work is closing. It doesn't matter how good it is. It's just... nowadays you need more than it just being good and full of good people.
And you don't think there'll be a bubble that'll burst. You don't think it'll come around again. That
unless they can find a way of making it. Unless they can find a way of making it £30.
Because are there any? I don't really know because obviously not in London. Are there many? Is there like a fringe scene?
Huge fringe scene. So. There's several. There's one, it's a company called Upstairs at the Gatehouse in Highgate, and that is most people's first job when leaving drama school, is they go and do a musical for Upstairs at the Gatehouse.
Yeah.
They do stuff like Hot Mikado, they've even done Avenue Q, they've done, you know, all sorts of kind of musicals on the periphery, and then there's Southwark Playhouse, and then there, you know, there are a good smattering of stuff.
These are very good tips, by the way, for anyone listening who's a bit like, I don't want to part with loads and loads of money.
But, you see, something like the Southwark Playhouse is now having to charge £25 for Fringe. Mm. It's too much for Fringe.
Yeah.
You want to be paying £10 maximum. But even on a sellout at £10, you can't even begin to pay your actors, let alone make your money back. It's the same with the Edinburgh Festival. So
yeah, it's difficult because that's the thing. You want musicals to still retain the same quality, but it's just so expensive to see them.
Yeah, and so actors work for free, by and large, in fringe venues, and there's been a big movement now to try and get actors to be paid the minimum wage, but it's simply not viable because even on a sellout, same as Edinburgh Festival, there are so many shows here that if you play under a capacity of, let's say, roughly 60 to 80, it doesn't matter how many tickets you sell, you can't make your money back. And so fringe is like that. And so you start to force them to pay actors as well. You can't put it on in the first place. And so, you end up in this kind of catch-22 situation where no one can put on new work unless they have trust fund. You know, so you end up writing becomes a hobby of the elite.
Yeah, or unless they you know have some sort of notoriety already and people will trust them. Ben Elton seems to do very well.
Quite, yes.
Or not so well. Oh,
yeah.
But yeah, no, it's you are right. It does become that sort of elitist thing. Yeah. I can afford to do this.
Yeah, so. I can afford to self-finance and I can afford to lose money. So I think that's why something like looking at kind of Book of Mormon and Jukebox and that, you know, if that is what, if that is the future of theatre, because that's the future, that's what people want to part with £60.
Interesting. I mean, I suppose it's good for people like us who are comedians, who love that sort of love the art form of musicals. It means that, well, maybe there's a gap to do things like that. Maybe, you know, people want really funny musicals and
people want, you want to get people in that don't go to musical theatre because there aren't enough musical theatre fans in the UK to support a musical. Like I said before, like more.
Or
people,
probably a podcast. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I'm not sure why I'm doing this. I'm doing it more for me than anything else. But I'm sure we will wheedle out those.
Well, I think there are musical theatre fans, but even those fans that there are there can't go and see them. They can't afford to see everything.
No, they can't. And obviously, or they don't live in London, and it's kind of a treat. It's kind of that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, people that work hard, so holidays, it's like, well, do I spend all this money going down to London?
But it's definitely, unlike the football, which is a once-a-week thing, I think. Yeah. So it's more people watch football on one Saturday than watch musicals in an entire year.
But I think a person who loves football wouldn't, it's weird. It's like the culture you've grown up in. Wouldn't it really bother them to spend £300 on a season ticket? But for somebody who loves musicals, they would be like, oh, I could not possibly go down for a weekend.
You'd pay £30 a weekend to watch every single, to watch football once a weekend or once every fortnight. But the same with musicals. It doesn't feel like.
I think it would seem like you were being really like.
Yeah.
Spending too much money, be very extravagant with
apparently
your money.
There is one woman that has seen every single matinee of Les Mis, every single Saturday matinee.
Oh my god, I wonder if I can get her on this podcast.
Apparently she spent £30,000 watching Les Mis.
Right, she should be given, she should be let to just see it now, shouldn't she, surely? Someone should step in, like Boo Bell.
She is buying tickets.
Like, somebody.
She's buying tickets.
Somebody needs to go, here you go, love. Like, get her a lanyard.
Yeah.
And like, I can just see it for free.
Yeah.
Because I'm paying my
30 grand watching Les Mis.
Sweet Lord!
Uh-huh.
I bet she hasn't seen the film ever either. I bet she's been like, no, not for me. I'm not doing an Orange Wednesday. I'll spend £30,000, but I'm not going to do an Orange. Well, Vicky Stone, I might leave it there because we've had quite the natter. Oh, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for
my
coming
pleasure.
And joining us on the Funny Girl podcast. Thank you very much.
Ooh. Nice.
I sincerely hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as I did recording it. It was great fun. Now, if you want to follow Vicky, she's on Twitter at Vicky Stone, and it's Vicky, V-I-K-K-I. And I think her website is vickystone.com, and all of her tour dates are on there. You should definitely try and catch her show. It's marvellous. The next podcast, when I put it up, was also recorded at the Fringe. It is with the pun meister himself, Tim Vine, and it was a joy to do. It was so silly and so daft. So I'll be putting it up in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, please feel free to tweet me at funnygirlpod, and thank you very much for joining me. Cheers, have a lovely week, guys. You've been listening to the Funny Girl Podcast with comedian Katie Mulgrew.